download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Sunday Night Saffron. Religion, politics, culture and lisping.
Hello, Father Bob. Yes, hello, dear listeners. Tonight we're going to be talking to a comic book writer whose latest comic book that he's written is about the Knights Templar, that subset of the Freemasons. And this dude's actually a Freemason himself.
Oh.
So he's going to tell us the truth.
Mm.
And, or maybe not, because you know the thing about the Freemasons is they're allowed to
exactly.
misrepresent for their own self-interest.
So dissimulate.
Mm. Then we're going to be talking to Deborah Lipstadt, who went to court with Holocaust denier David Irving.
Oh.
And we're talking to her because there's an Australian Holocaust revisionist, Frederick Tobin, who's in...
Roman Catholic, is he?
I don't know. I think it's irrelevant, unless you want to bring that up.
Well, I thought you might like to flog us on the way.
and he's been in trouble for 10 years because he's been told by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission and a court also that he has to pull down his website, and he's just not doing it, and it's been going on for 10 years, and the next step for him may be G-A-O-L jail. Anyway, so Deborah Lipstadt's across that sort of stuff. We're talking to her. We're also going to be talking about blogs and media censorship with Anthony Lowenstein, who's written The Blogging Revolution. And he doesn't want to be on this show.
No, I don't know that.
What happened is he got on this show, and then his publicist got a bit cocky, hey, why would we just go on... Now that we've locked that in, why would we just go on the low-rating Sunday night dreck?
All right.
Why wouldn't we try out to get on The Hack? You know, that's Triple J in the afternoon that has far more people listening.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of like tried that on, and then that didn't work. The Hack didn't want him. And then like they had to come back crawling with their tails between their legs. Yeah, like can we get back on the show now? But I think the way he looks at it is that we're the show that's stopping him from being on the higher rating show.
What's he addicted to us?
Because I think the Hack's position was that once we were sort of semi-locked in, it's like bad manners to kind of take the guest off us and put them on the Hack. So I think the Hack politely was saying, no, you have him. But Lowenstein's just going to be like, if it wasn't for Saffron and Father Bob, I could have been on the higher rating show.
I see. Well, bad manners are the least of our worries, surely.
And we're going to be but we're going to have a Qawwali group playing Religious Song of the Week. Don't say that we're...
And it's Ramadan.
Don't say we're into tokenism, because this is the second Qawwali band that we've had on in a month. Mm. So it's not like we have one Qawwali band
us.
On.
They're talking about us as being maybe...
What?
Reverting to Islam.
Who's talking about that on the guest book or something?
I think there's... They're talking.
What, we have too many... What?
Well,
I'm going to a Ramadan dinner tomorrow night.
What, at 10:30 or something?
Because unlike you, who's, you just stay in your little presbytery thing or whatever...
Well, you're out.
I get contacted by multi-faith organisations, the ones that try to bring the people together. So
of course.
So, I don't start, I don't drive down Sydney Road... because I'm a kind of a Jew and start smashing the windows of the halal butcher shop.
All right.
And,
that's well known, I presume.
And the Christians don't sort of come on down to Carlisle Street and start lighting the bagelries on fire. Mm-hmm. So there's interfaith groups that try to bring the people together.
Yes.
So their current activity, one of their things is during Ramadan, they try to invite people who aren't Muslim to Ramadan dinner. So on Monday night, tomorrow night, I'm going to a Ramadan dinner.
Are you as a guest?
Yes.
An honoured guest.
Yes.
Mm.
So,
after dark.
I imagine it's going to be awkward, but nothing to do with interfaith things. More like just awkward because I'm like, I just have to sit there and kind of.
Yeah, you won't like that, will you?
Yeah, I'm awkward.
How long can you sit still for?
By the way, Muslim, if at the Ramadan dinner, if you see that I'm awkward tomorrow night, it's nothing to do with.
Nah.
The Muslim thing's totally irrelevant.
It's just an affliction.
If I was that Richard Dawkins atheist.
You would still be the same.
Yeah, I'd just sit there awkwardly.
Hmm.
I'm awkward around my father, if I've brought up in previous...
But you're awkward even if you're on your own.
Yes.
Isn't it?
But my father, if he comes over, when we're putting up the curtains and stuff, I'm awkward there.
What do you mean we're putting up the curtains? How many have you got in this flat? I thought you were on your own.
What do you mean?
Are you hiding something?
Me and my father putting up the curtains.
Both, I thought somebody else was there putting up the
and
curtains.
And then, like, when he goes at the end, I go, okay, bye-bye, and then we, like, shake hands.
Yeah, that's nice, isn't it?
And that's my own father.
And you say, excuse me, could I ask you a name? Who have you been for the last... Anyway, that's only the introduction to the show, so if anybody had the vaguest intention of staying on for 2 hours, I presume they will have given up by now.
Coming up next, Stephen Defoe. What is it? I think he actually, on his CV, not only is he a Freemason, I think he was in the Knights Templar, whatever that means.
Oh, it's beer.
But I'm not sure the 2008 Knights Templar is the same as the olden days Jerusalem one, where you're like going around in your, what's that called? That
chain mail.
Sword fighting.
All of that.
Yeah.
Well, he won't be allowed past security here.
Anyway, we're going to talk to him next.
Jealousy by Sparkadia. Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J. That's a new thing I was practicing all week.
Thank you.
Do you think that'll help?
It will help. Thank you, Father Bob.
Thank you.
Joining us from just outside of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, is expert on the Knights Templar and writer of new comic book about the Knights Templar, Stephen Defoe. How are you?
I'm terrific.
Now, you're not just an outside observer to all this phenomena. You're actually like a member of various Masonic groups, or you have been in the past?
No, I'm still a member of the Freemasons and belong to a number of Masonic organizations, including one that is called the Knights Templar.
And how is the Knights Templar in 2008 that you're a member of connected to the famous Knight Templars of days of old?
In name only.
Ah, okay. So you don't get to fight with swords and stuff?
No, I'm afraid not. There are a number of Templar organizations in existence today that claim a direct lineal descent to the original Templars. There are certainly some Freemasons that would like to believe and do believe that the Masonic Templars are connected, but...
Tell us about the old Knight Templars.
Well, that's a rather long subject.
Give us the blurb, like, for people who know nothing about who these Knights Templar are.
In 1119 it all started, didn't it?
It depends on which one of the old chronicles you want to accept. Certainly William of Tyre gave a date of 1118 AD as the start. But in a nutshell, the Templars grew out of the results of the First Crusade, when Christianity had captured Jerusalem and the surrounding areas. A number of military orders grew up to help in that fight. The Templars were the first of those military orders that actually performed a military role. They existed for approximately 200 years, growing to be arguably the best known and certainly the wealthiest of those orders.
And then what happened? Did the Vatican turn on them?
Well, you know, that's one of the things. A lot of historians in the past have made Pope Clement V an equal villain in the story. And in reality, although Clement certainly played a part, the majority of their downfall was Philip IV, the King of France. We're talking 1307 when he had all the Templars arrested on October 13th.
And was that like a power thing where he thought, well, I can't be the top guy in the land and them at the same time?
Well, you know, again, it you know, so much of this history is open to interpretation. The consensus seems to be that you know, he coveted their assets and decided to wipe them out. And it had come from some rumors which had been started by a member, a former member of the order, and he certainly wanted to listen to that because he had an axe to grind against them, and had them arrested. Now, again, as I said earlier, historians have long felt that Pope Clement was an active participant in that, but in actual fact, he was aware of these rumors of heresy that were being bandied about, and said that he would launch an investigation in October of 1307, but by that time, Philip was well on his way to making plans to arrest them.
Now, how accurate is all the Dan Brown-style talk that the Knights Templar have existed since then for thousands of years, kind of underground as some sort of secret society?
Absolutely pure rubbish.
Damn.
You know, everybody wants to believe a conspiracy. And, you know, you'll usually find the Templars and the Freemasons knee-deep in the midst of it. But, Brown wrote, not the best novel in the world, but certainly one that has captivated the minds of people. And I'm certainly not going to knock it because myself and many other authors have made a buck by presenting the historical side of what, Brown has turned people onto.
And Friday the 13th, John, that's when they were wiped out. That's why it's supposed to be the unluckiest day of the year.
And so why did you get involved with the Freemasons? Like, what are they to you, if not a cool secret society?
Well, you know, like many Freemasons, I mean, you know, we can say, oh, I was attracted to the Masons because it was a secret society with all these mysteries. But at the end of the day, most men who join the Freemasons do so because of a personal connection with someone they know that is a Freemason, and that was certainly the case with myself. I knew a man, a friend of mine named Frank Gibbs. He was a good man with good, solid character and integrity. And when I found out that he was a Mason, I thought, you know what, if this organization would have a guy like that involved, then it's something I should look into.
And were you religious?
I certainly had and have faith. I wasn't, you know, devoutly religious, but then Freemasonry isn't a religious organization.
Because people say that things like the Freemasons, it's for, we have this need inside us for ritual in our life because it's kind of fun and meaningful and connects to our spirituality. And then if you don't happen to be part of some religious family or religious upbringing, then the Freemasons and groups like that are a good sort of substitute, proxy.
Well, you know, one of Freemasonry's long-standing claims, and it's certainly valid, is that Freemasonry is not a religion, nor is it a substitute for one. When you join the Freemasons, you leave with the religion that you came with. If you're a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim,
but don't they believe in a God? Or don't they say you should believe in a God? So Richard Dawkins couldn't really come and join the Freemasons.
No, Richard Dawkins couldn't join. You're absolutely correct, John. One of the requirements of Freemasonry in most parts of the world, there are some branches in France that do admit atheists, but they in turn are not recognized by the ones that require that you have a belief in a supreme being.
So what would happen at your average Freemason meeting? Or are you just going to either lie to us because that's the plan or not tell us because it's a big secret?
No, John, I'm not going to lie to you, but if I told you what happened at the average Freemason's meeting, it would make for some very boring radio.
Okay, but surely you do some ritualistic stuff. Don't you have like a skull hidden like in a little safe behind one of the rocks?
Ritual forms an integral part of a Masonic. When I say a Masonic meeting, there are many different branches of Freemasonry: the Royal Arch, the Knights Templar, the Cryptic Rite. Each branch of Freemasonry has its own ritual and ceremonies. The rituals are intended to teach philosophical lessons. And the ritual comes into play when you open the lodge and you close the lodge. It's a very formal ceremony. But the real purpose of the ritual is in the initiation.
Yes.
And in the case of what we refer to as craft Freemasonry, or in the United States, they call it Blue Lodge, somewhat of a colloquialism that I'm not a big fan of, but that's beside the point.
Me and Bob, talking about ritual, so we can get to the meat of the matter, we've just been reading this book called The Secret History of the World by Jonathan Black, which talks about the Freemasons a lot. He's quite pro-Freemason, and he says in these initiation ceremonies throughout the ages, Freemasons, they've tried to simulate death. So the initiate feels like he's died or he's about to die or he really, really is about to die, really, really. So they might do that by he thinks he's going to get shot, he thinks he's going to get crushed or something, and that's meant to help prepare the initiate for, you know, when he really does die and help him in the afterlife. Do you have simulation of death ceremonies in the Freemason?
Well, certainly the question of a man's immortality plays a role in the third degree. I haven't read this book. I've heard a bit about it and heard mixed reviews about it. I know 40 and Times, a major UK publication, wasn't too thrilled with it. But yeah, no, certainly death and the afterlife.
When you were initiated, is that what happened? They tried to pretend you're about to be killed or die?
Well, it's rather complicated to try and explain.
You won't tell us?
Well, all of this stuff is readily available for anyone to find.
Google it. We could Google it.
You could Google it. You could MSN it. Sure,
of course.
It's all out there. But no, certainly. Man's mortality and death plays a role in the third degree of what is called craft masonry.
So you're not going to cough up anything.
No, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave it buried.
Now,
but where is it? Where is he getting the idea that they make you feel like you're going to be shot?
Because apparently, what happens is if you go through that on Earth under the sort of like the professional guidance of these Freemasons, you know, all the ways of old, that's going to help you when you actually die, because when you actually die, you go floating into the spirit world, and all those lessons you've learned in the Freemason initiation meetings that you're not going to tell us about because you've been sworn to secrecy and you're possibly worried that the Freemasons will assassinate you if you say anything about it.
And let's not forget brainwashed as well. That's a major component.
But it's supposed to be part of the initiation of the Templars too, an experience of horror. And great fear and trembling in the face of death.
That is actually not correct. With regard to the Templars, we have access today. I mean, you can buy a book called The Rule of the Templars by Judith Upton Ward, and it has the ceremony of reception of the original Templars in it. And there certainly isn't anything there isn't anything of that nature in there.
Now, when's your comic book, Outrema, The Saga of the Knights Templar, when's that coming out?
It's due out in October. I'm shooting for October 13th for obvious reasons.
Excellent, because I'm lazy and stupid, but even I can read a comic book. So thank you very much for bringing it out in that form.
Yeah, it's a little different. I mean, I've done several books on the actual history of the Templars, and being a lifelong comic geek, I thought, you know what, let's do this in this sequential art form.
Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen Defoe, and and I'm sure we'll have lots of listeners who think they know the real secrets behind the Freemasons contacting us.
Okay.
Heaps Good by Muff and Plutonic. John, Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Now, the journalists from the Melbourne Fairfax paper, The Age, went on strike. And what happens when the journalists go on strike is the editors, who sort of like, say, the management, have to, like, throw the paper together themselves, which is kind of not as hard as it sounds because you've got all, like, the Associated Press stories from overseas, and like there's a way to kind of cobble it together without your local journalist, right?
Yeah.
But then what you have to do, you have to write your own headlines. And this is where, seriously, it was like, I really think they fell over because they'll just, it was like if, for example, I couldn't do the show with 1 week and then my dad came in and tried to do it. You know what I mean? And so the big mistake that the Age management did when the journalists went on strike, when they were writing their headlines, is they started putting exclamation marks in headlines. Where does that happen? How can you get it so long? And they started having like really like obvious bad puns. Like the most obvious thing that is like St Kilda won, the St Kilda Football Club won. So then there's an article and then the headline is Oh, when the saints come marching in! Exclamation mark! Don't do the exclamation mark next time the journal's like, they had, and then they just see things that didn't even quite make any sense, like a picture of a summer of Obama.
Obama.
And the headline, "The Obama Stakes of America!" Exclamation mark!
Another exclamation mark. But this, is the strike resolved?
I felt like, I was so embarrassed for, I felt like being a scab and crossing the line. Just so I could, like, get there and tell the manager, stop, you're looking like idiots. Yes. Stop putting exclamation marks in headlines.
Don't put yourself in harm's way.
It's like, that's where you can always tell there's something sus with a little quote on a movie poster. Like, where it's like, supposedly some journalist said, a triumph, exclamation mark. I've never read an article in my life, besides The Age, where any journalist ever puts an exclamation mark in a story to try to...
Well, you have me looking for them now.
I am here in Iraq, and there's bombs going off!
Exclamation mark!
Now, the big news this week, of course, has been because of the Democrats getting Obama in, which was just, it was striking a blow for hot people.
Yes.
Because he's like, he's pretty attractive.
Yes.
And like, there's like shots of him sort of down at the beach in Hawaii and stuff, and it like... Seriously, considering he's like in his mid-40s, he's pretty buff. And he's been striking a great blow for like healthy, hot people. Oh. But now the Republicans have answered by bringing in Sarah Palin.
Indeed. Who shoots mooses and things.
Yeah, who's hot herself.
And not hair moose.
So now if you determine who you're going to vote for based on the hotness.
Yeah.
Of the candidates. Now, it's a bit of a toss-up because both Obama and Sarah Palin are pretty hot.
And God bless America.
Did you see the when she gave her speech? And then the guy, you know how that 18-year-old now has to marry her daughter because he got her pregnant or whatever?
Yeah, and on television.
I know, so he's sort of like sitting there. He's obviously like just not really like... the highest IQ type of guy. And he's sitting there frigging chewing gum. Yeah. And then at the end, when, like, the family goes on stage to meet Sarah, he's there, he's still chewing gum, like some frigging low-class, you know.
It might endear him to the mums, though. They'll say, oh, he's just like my son-in-law.
Oh, yes. Or maybe he was chewing tobacco.
It could have been anything, or chewing the fat.
Mm. The other thing about Sarah Palin is... the guy she's married to is part Eskimo. How cool's that?
Oh, geez. Has he been on the stage?
In what way?
In with her at these.
Yeah, he just stands. He's part Eskimo.
I don't want to see the Republicans.
Why not?
Well, I'm nervous because they're all so. You know what I mean?
No, we don't know what
redneck.
You mean.
Redneck.
Ah, yes.
It frightens me. See?
Yeah, I guess
it worries me.
No, I understand.
Because they talk like, if I find people, they like shooting things and they seem to, she's coughing it all up as though this is going to be the unique selling point. I like shooting moose. You know what I mean? Now, if that's the truth, and I mean, she couldn't be joking, and I mean, she, presumably it's not Colbert or something, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's serious stuff.
Yeah.
Well, then that makes me even more nervous about the US of A.
So you have empathy for moose or what? What's your point?
I don't like all this business of, listen, I'm just a normal US of A white woman.
Yes.
And my pastime is not kind of, you know, bowling or something. It's shooting moose.
Mm.
But I know they'll say Alaska and there's moose all over the place and you're not careful, the moose will overrun the state. So she's out doing the right thing and she's shooting the ears off the moose.
Yes.
You see what I mean? And then using moose for her, between her ears.
It's easy for you to be here in your...
I know.
...inner city Melbourne, like, criticising moose shooters. But you're
know.
It's like, if you don't shoot moose in Alaska...
Yeah,
it's
I know.
They're like, they'll take over Parliament.
Easily, you see. I mean, that might be their surprise card, you see, that they'll produce a moose at the last minute.
Coming up next, we're going to be talking to arguably the world's expert... in Holocaust denial, Deborah Lipstadt.
One month off. by Block Party John, Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Father Bob, I was reading this article. Hasn't got a lot of press in Australia, but Holocaust revisionist Frederick Tobin should be jailed for criminal contempt of court if he can't afford a fine, the federal court has been told. Dr. Tobin faces a contempt finding in the federal court in Adelaide, accused of failing to stop publishing racist Holocaust denial material on his Adelaide Institute website. Now, to negotiate us through this minefield of awkwardness all about Holocaust denial and censorship, arguably the world's foremost expert in this topic, Deborah Lipstadt, who's an American historian and author of the book Denying the Holocaust, joining us from Atlanta, USA. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Thank you very much for staying up so late over there so you can, feed our brains with information.
I'll try.
Now, possibly the best way to get into this is talking about your story of how you ended up in court with the famous international Holocaust denier, David Irving. Why were you in court with David Irving?
I wrote a book in the early 90s about Holocaust denial, and in it I devoted about 200, 300 words to David Irving. I called him a Holocaust denier and said he knew the truth, but he twisted it to fit his pre-existing conclusions and that he lied, et cetera, et cetera. And I also made the argument that Holocaust denial is a form of both racism and anti-Semitism. And he sued me for libel in England when the book came out there. And I had to go into court to defend myself. And to make a very long story short, what we did was follow his footnotes, in other words, prove that he indeed twisted the information, lied, made up, etc. And in a close to 300, over 300-page judgment, the judge found completely for us.
And the framing that that court case is occasionally given, and you can tell me if this is true or not, is that he took you to court because he wanted the Holocaust to go on trial so he could bring his evidence and then you'd be forced to bring your evidence that the Holocaust happened. And then, obviously, in David Irving's head, he was going to prevail at the end, but that didn't happen.
Right. Well, I think I don't know what he expected. I never got inside his head that way to know that. But what we argued, and the judge agreed with us, and then two courts of appeal agreed with us as well, that we weren't proving what happened. We were proving that the methods deniers use, the so-called evidence they bring, is composed of lies, distortions, inventions. It's made up. Things are pulled out, made up out of whole cloth, twisted. So we weren't proving what happened. We were proving that what deniers say happened, and that their side of the story, so to speak, is just a complete lie.
Some of the most interesting challenges to Holocaust deniers I've read haven't been from anti-racist campaigners or Jewish campaigners with an agenda. It's been from the skeptic community. Well, like people who are against creationism getting into the classroom, and people who are against pseudoscience and pseudo-history. And one of their things that they like to talk about amongst that is how they think Holocaust denial just doesn't add up.
Right. Well, the skeptic community, actually, I was, not to make a pun, but I was somewhat skeptical when they first got involved. But they have really done a wonderful job. There are a number of authors and people who debunk myths. And they just look at this stuff and they take it apart, as do historians. They just look at it logically, and they look at when a denier says this document says X and you look at the document and it says A, B, C, or D, you got to say it doesn't add up. And that's basically what they are. They're bluffing, but they throw all sorts of pseudo facts at you, and they sound very authoritative. When it's just, one of our expert witnesses, a prominent historian, said in the court, it's a tissue of lies.
Michael Shermer, who's one of these skeptics, who,
right,
again,
he does some good work.
Yeah, again, he's not like an anti-racist campaigner or anything like that. It's just, you know, he just thinks, oh my God, how depressing if the world gets suckered into this. He brings up like some of the sort of tricky arguments that they bring up, and like one of them, we've kind of talked about this before, Bob, is like, if I said to you, Bob, prove to me you haven't flown to the North Pole in the last year.
Yeah.
It's like you could say, I've brought no evidence that you've
you've gone to the North Pole in the last year, but on some level you'd have to agree on some theoretical abstract level that you can never, you know.
I can't give you the proof.
Yeah, you can't give me the proof. And that's in so much Holocaust denial when you read it, it is like that. They throw up this vague hypothetical that you sort of you
but
can't.
Surely the numbers are there, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Because the Germans did keep all the numbers, didn't they?
Right. This is the best. It has the dubious distinction. The Holocaust has the dubious distinction of being the best documented genocide in history. So, but you just have to look at the so-called evidence. There's the Schirmer approach or the skeptic approach, where you take it apart on a logical ground. I'll give you another example like that, where deniers like to say the Nazis were so powerful and so successful that if they had wanted to kill all the Jews, none of the Jews would survive. So the very fact that they're people who claim to be survivors of the Holocaust proves that it's just a myth because the Nazis were so successful and so at everything they wanted to do. Well, let me point out this. They wanted to win the war, and they didn't win the war, you know. So there are lots of those logical arguments, but they're also, in my case, we went more to the historical data that when David Irving and, by extension, all deniers would say, we have this document that says such and such, and you look at the document and you go back and look at the actual so-called evidence they're producing, and it just doesn't say that. That's why the judge, in every single issue that came up in the trial, and it was a 12-week trial, found for us.
Now, when your nemesis went to jail in, was it in Germany or was it in Austria?
In Austria.
In Austria. Rather than you relishing it, you actually said that that's not the right thing to happen. Holocaust deniers shouldn't go to jail.
I'm against laws outlawing Holocaust denial because for a number of reasons. First of all, I come from a tradition of free speech, number one. Number two, I don't think they're efficacious. I don't think they work. I think they tend to turn, whether it's Frederick Tobin, who's a pretty sorry character, or David Irving, who's an equally sorry character, into martyrs. Suddenly they can present themselves as martyrs for free speech. But there is something else that has to be taken into consideration, that many countries, unlike the United States, and the United States does have some hate speech laws, but many countries have much stricter hate speech laws. For instance, in France, it's not just a matter of free speech. There's certain people have the right of free speech, but the person who's being attacked also has the right against being attacked, being demeaned. So if they're breaking these laws, then it's according to the country in which the laws operate. I wouldn't be in favor of laws against Holocaust denial in the United States because it just is contrary to the First Amendment.
It's interesting
and
when people...
Also, the other thing to remember is that some of these deniers, a David Irving, a Frederick Tobin, when they go places, they're really often sometimes bordering on, and I can't give you... we don't have time to go into specific examples, but incitement. You know, it's one thing to say, I hate yellow people, or I hate green people. But it's another thing to go out and say, I hate green people, and if you come across a green person, you know, make sure you attack them or you somehow incite the crowd to go against them. And that's what a lot of these deniers do. And that's why certain courts, I think including your own, have been much more vigilant towards about what they say.
Often when people oversimplify it, I've noticed they say, oh, the West is trying to suppress Holocaust denial. But, like, that's just far too simple.
Because
you have to divide it up and, like, America, as you said, which is surely one of the big countries in the West, it's not only do they not suppress Holocaust denial, but by rolling out the internet, they've given Holocaust denial the biggest windfall ever.
That's exactly right. Well, the internet, you know, the internet is like a book. Books can be used for good and books can be used for bad. One of the projects that I've become involved in since my trial is creation of a website, www.hdot, it stands for Holocaust Denial on Trial, hdot.org. And on it, we've created a myths and facts section to appeal exactly to your listeners who don't want to go into long, long treatises and long, long discussions of the intricacy of Holocaust denial, though there is that information there. But simply we say, look, this is what a denier says. A gas chamber was impossible. And then we give points 1, 2, 3, 4 why this information is wrong. And the unique thing about this site is the vast majority of the information we use is information that was used in my trial. So that means the judge in my trial heard it, judge in the courts of appeals heard it, a tribunal in the courts of appeals heard this information. So this information has been adjudicated in three different courts and found to stand up, you know, and to expose Holocaust deniers.
How does David Irving now rationalize that his evidence went up to a court, and a court where he obviously respected it enough to start the fight in the first place? You didn't take him to court, he took you to court, and that the court has rejected his version of things, as it's three times,
you know,
you say?
First he was just a Holocaust denier and then denier, and then after the court case, he became a judgment denier. If you had him on this case, he'd say, oh, I won. The judge said I was a very good historian. The judge said I was a great military historian. The judge had about 10 sentences, or even fewer than that, saying, oh, David Irving is a very good military historian. And then when he turned to the body of everything that was saying, that was brought up in the court, and on that website I just mentioned, h.org, you also have the judge's, the judgment, he says it's a travesty, he lies, he makes up, it's tendacious, it's far-fetched, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you can twist anything you want. I didn't take him to court. I don't believe in suing. He sued me. I fought like the Dickens. He thought I would back down because, you know, I was far away. I'm an American. I'm a woman. I wouldn't fight him. I fought with every bit of energy I could muster. I had great lawyers. And we went in and put up a tricky defense. There was no Perry Mason moment. You know, aha, we got him. It was simply by the facts. And by the way, I've written a book on this called History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving. And in fact, I was in Australia about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, on a book tour. And the book, I think, is available in Australia. But just if you read it, you'll see there was no magic moment where we produced a secret document or something. We just unpacked what he said and unraveled what he said based on the facts, just the facts.
There's something a bit irritating about how Holocaust deniers play the free speech card, which
it
is
really
fair
is.
Enough, like I'm on their side on that level, but then the leading Holocaust denier took you to court to try to get your book pulped.
Bingo, absolutely correct. He takes me to court to try to get my book pulped. He threatens anybody who's going to write anything bad about him so that publishers are afraid to publish in places such as the UK where the libel laws favor the plaintiff, favor the claimant. So he shuts down everything that's critical, but when he gets criticized or, runs into problems in Austria, he suddenly plays the free speech card. These people have no moral backbone, so to speak. They'll play whatever works for them, and I think that's also what the skeptic people are very good at exposing.
Thank you very much for joining us, Deborah. And
now
you can go to sleep.
I'm going to do exactly that. Take care. Bye-bye.
Now by Mates of State, John, a Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
You went to
Bendigo
last night?
Not last week. Thursday night, I was in Bendigo.
What happened?
And I had to go up and talk to a bunch of roaming Catholics in the hotel, Foundry Arms Hotel. Full, for God's, not the Catholics, but the hotel. It was a thrill getting out of the... If you like going out of the city, long drive, now in three quarters. Beautiful sun setting. Beautiful music on the magic. What's its name?
NWA.
Yeah, and whatever. And off we go in. And there's 250 roaming Catholics.
Yeah, what happened?
Sober. They listened to me. I told them beautiful, deep, and meaningful things. Jumped in the car and drove home. But I sinned on the way home. Do you want to hear about the sin?
Yes.
And I'm finding, Doctor.
I hope it's sex related.
I'm finding, Doctor, that this is happening often. In fact, I'm accepting invitations to go away to speak to do this sin. You know what it is? I drive home and I go straight to Macca's. And I get the fattest
point.
Bloody chicken plus bacon.
What?
And medium chips. See? And then I drove frantic. I had the chips all over the floor by the time I drove out of the Macca's. So what is this? Is this some kind of passion? Chips stuck everywhere.
Do you know what? I did a few things this week.
Where'd you go? Paris.
No, again, it was a thing where it was a collection of things where I didn't really want to go, but then I did the reverse psychology thing in my head with, oh, sometimes when you don't want to go somewhere and then you end up going, it ends up being like
oh,
the great...
Oh, beautiful.
Yes.
Yes. So you talked yourself into it.
Well, I got a weird email during the week when, do you know, have you seen this film called Dig? And it's about this band called the Brian Jonestown Massacre and how they had fights and often like actual violent fights with the Dandy Warhols, this other band.
Oh.
And the lead singer of the Brian Jonestown Massacre is this guy that is generally acknowledged as being a bit, what's a polite way of saying they can suddenly just break into violence?
Oh, psycho.
Maybe. Anton Newcomb, right? So I get this email, because they're touring, I get this email in the middle of the week from his people saying he wanted to meet me. Like, because in this weird thing, like he'd seen me on YouTube or something, and he'd sort of like got a bit, I don't know.
He identified with another psycho.
So all I knew about the Brian Jonestown Massacre and Anton Newcomb is what I'd seen in this doco where it's like, and
ripping Chook's heads off.
Well, no, I think he gets like angry at fans and stuff. He's quite famous for like just jumping into the audience if he thinks someone's not
paying attention.
Yes, and like repeatedly like bashing their skull in.
Oh, he's interactive.
Yes. So then I was like, oh,
a bash pit.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, do I want to go or don't? But I actually the beating I could have got that wasn't the thing that was concerning me. It was more like just. Look, because, dear listener, I'm like you. I just don't like situations where you walk somewhere and you're, like, the centre of it. I just like blending in. And there's nothing more than I'm going to be the centre of attention than I walk into the after party where I've been, you know, asked for, like he's the queen. What's the word? When the queen tells you to turn up or whatever?
Yes, royal command.
By royal command, Anton Newcomb has told me to come to the thing. So I just didn't want to do it because I just didn't want to be have like everyone looking at it or whatever. But I went anyway, so it was okay.
Was it okay?
He kind of pitched me a few ideas.
Oh, did he? Well, yes. Were you there at the performance as well as the after party?
Yeah, I went to the performance too. Which was pretty good.
So you didn't get bashed during
I didn't get bashed during the thing.
He set you up or
he
something?
He stops like after songs, he like stops for like up to 10 minutes. He just doesn't care, right? Because if he thinks like the bass is on the wrong level or some guitar string. Yeah, and if it takes 10 minutes, it takes 10 minutes, right? And then he sort of, like, snaps at the audience if they're getting annoyed that in between each song there's 10 minutes. Like, he goes, listen, I didn't come all the way here to play this song back. But then when they actually play, they do sound quite good. So you do respect him for, like...
That's professionalism.
Yeah, professionalism. But he was really testing the audience's patience, which becomes entertainment within itself.
Yeah.
Because, like, people get furious and stuff. And then as with most things, it's a totally different experience if you paid for a $60 ticket or you got one for free. When you get one for free, you can sit there and just relax and have a jovial time and go, well, this is okay. I don't mind that
but
there's 10-minute games.
But you wouldn't be saying, well, that's only $30 worth.
Mm. And so he was pitching me these ideas afterwards, like for segments on my shows.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I was like, this is the – can you –
What, on your wireless shows or your television shows?
No, television shows.
Oh.
And so this is the face I did when he was pitching.
Yes.
Can you explain that face to the board?
That face, he's nodding his head, dear listeners, and he's gritting his teeth. Right? So I
thought some of the ideas. This is one of his ideas of Anton Newcomb, who, like, I didn't know him before this week. Or he said to me, he goes, that me and him should go to NASA and pitch them camouflage, I think both camouflage space outfits and also camouflage like rocket paint. So what it is, you paint on your space outfit, like it's you paint it like dark blue with stars and stuff on it.
And so then you can't be seen.
And then you also paint the rocket ship. But I couldn't figure out whether that was the idea or he thought that was like a prank and we secretly film it or whatever.
Yes.
I really had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, but you nodded your head like that
I
and gritted
my
your
head,
teeth.
Yes.
Ah. Did eventually he give up or?
No, I got his...
More ideas.
Yeah, he had other ideas. That was the most succinct one, though.
But that's a fascinating one, isn't it?
And everyone, it was one of these...
So the aliens couldn't see you at
the
all.
The best bit of it was that, like, everyone else who was around him, like, they all, like, gush. Like, they're his, like, loyal, like, they just...
Acolytes.
Yeah, they just think he's the bomb. And, like, all the other Australians who were there, like, the reason they'd somehow lied and cheated their way into this after party, right? And, like, they were all in awe of Anton from the Brian Jonestown Massacre, right? And then I just didn't care. You know what I mean? Like, I was just casual, like, you know. But he was, like, spending the whole time with me. And so my cachet in the room just went up so much. Everyone was like, who is this wondrous oracle, John?
Yeah, exactly.
That Anton from the Brian Jonestown Massacre not only doesn't cave in his skull, like he seems to do with lots of
other
people.
Most of his visitors.
But
yes.
It appears Anton's hanging off John. So I was like, my cachet has never been higher in my entire life.
Did you record any of this,
No.
Posterity or?
No. Nah.
You didn't take secret pictures of it with a lapel camera?
No. I've got a photo.
A webcam.
I've got a photo of me with him. Someone gave him a didgeridoo or something.
An Aboriginal musical instrument.
Yeah, I was backstage here and so, like, someone came up. And it was, like, this long thing covered
right.
in newspaper.
Yeah.
And it was, like, someone had just brought him a didgeridoo.
Beautiful. What did you take?
Nothing. I brought nothing.
Oh, don't you have to take things to after parties?
I don't think so.
Oh,
I don't know.
Fair enough.
Do you know the big lie about after parties? I realised this. I went to Pulp toured about 10 years ago. I went to the Pulp after party. And do you know who goes there? It's not like all these interesting, you know, fascinating
artistic. No A-list
there. No A-list whatsoever. Do you know who goes there? It's like the store managers from JB Hi-Fi. Yeah. And record shops, like that's sort of like, and so Jarvis Cocker and the member of the Pulp, they go there and it's like part of the deal of being in a band with their record. It's like make the store managers from JB Hi-Fi feel like they're part of some scene. So then they'll put your album on display,
yes.
Like in a prominent thing.
But you find that's not a highly intellectual gathering of people.
No, I'm just saying that's
say that.
Yes, I'm just doing, I'm... whatever.
Yeah,
commenting.
You're just
myth-busting.
Yeah. Oh, that was an exciting... What else did you do this week?
I went to a fashion show.
What, blokes or...?
What do you mean? What?
What kind of a fashion show?
Well, it's like some Melbourne Fashion Week or something.
People, don't you remember where you were?
The catwalk.
Ah. And go on. I mean, what impression did you have of the coming spring fashions? Well, you didn't pay any attention at all.
Well, they looked fine. The clothes looked good. They were fine. They seemed to like... The thing I like...
That's where you got your outfit from tonight.
The thing I did like about the fashion show, about the models, which I appreciated, so good on you models for this, is I've noticed some models do the ironic smile when they're... Like Megan Gale does it, where she pulls this smug little face as if she's, like, above it all. Like,
yeah.
Like
what am I doing here?
Yeah, I'm above all this. And so, like, I know... Like, all the other models are, like, idiot clothes horse, but I'm somehow the meta model who's... Yeah. But all the models here didn't pull that smug, ironic face. They walked out, you know, politely.
Yeah, it's nicely.
Nicely, and then showed their clothes and then walked back.
You didn't make any notes?
What was I going to frigging say?
Well,
I don't know.
The same.
They were wearing
future
ridiculous
partner.
There were clothes where I was like, why? Actually, most of the clothes I couldn't imagine them being worn in any context besides up there. They were a bit too strange. You know what I mean? Like the boys had like these tight, shiny, blue, sparkly things that I just went through my head. Like who would be
wearing those?
Yes, out of all my friends, I was thinking. Jeremy Weinstein, no, he wouldn't wear them. George Weinberg, no,
Me?
He wouldn't wear them. You, no, you wouldn't wear them. My dad, no.
No.
Rabbi Groner.
Does anybody wear them at all apart from the catwalk?
I couldn't think of anyone who they would be appropriate clothes on. But, you know, I'm sure these fashion designers know what they're doing.
So you weren't there as kind of a guest appearance?
Well, these two people I know, this husband and wife, they were one of the designers.
Oh.
And they're like my friends, so I kind of... went along to clap.
But you could have sprung up onto the catwalk and actually showed off your own clothes. See? Which might have brought a gasp to the... Right.
We'll talk
boring,
more.
Boring, boring, I know.
We'll talk more after this.
Youth group with All This Will Pass, John, Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
Joining us from a little booth in Sydney to talk about his new book, The Blogging Revolution, journalist Anthony Lowenstein. How are you?
Thanks for having me again on.
I know you didn't want to be on this show.
He says that, Anthony.
I know the backstory. This is the backstory. Oh, your publicist, once we were locked in, got cocky and was like, oh, actually, can we get him on, like, The Hack, because that rates far higher than our show?
Look,
And then when it didn't work, she came crawling back, tail between her legs, to get back on this. But it's fine.
Well, I've never heard that story. I mean, you know, I'm sort of kept above that loop, you know, so... I mean, I'm so honoured to be on this show again, as I always are. You know that.
Okay, fair enough. And also, by the way, dear listener, if you notice me being like not getting in a fight with Anthony this time, like I do other times, it's only because I keep on bumping into your father.
I've heard. My father always says such wonderful things about you. Initially, not so much, but now he likes you. Yeah.
So it actually would be rather than I'd prefer just to have a total. Sappy, where I kind of just kiss your butt and don't challenge anything interview. Yeah. I'd prefer to have that so I don't have awkward moments with your father when I bump into him, then sort of have a challenging interview where I, you know, confront you about your insane, illogical views.
Well, as I said to you, my father's kind of come round to really liking you, John. Initially, it was a bit touch and go. Okay. He said you were a bit quiet and strange, but now he likes you.
At least he agrees with you on Castro.
Now, can we talk about this book, The Blogging Revolution? What's the premise here?
Basically, it's a look at the internet in repressive regimes. So last year I went to Cuba, Egypt, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia and China, and looking at how the web is changing dissent in those countries and how Western multinationals such as Google, Yahoo and Microsoft often go into some of these countries like China amongst others and are helping the regimes with their filtering and censorship. And I guess also finally at how, in my view, much the Western media, particularly since 9/11, has failed in giving us a sense of these countries, which are really either, I guess, allies of the West or enemies of the West. And the web is one way to gauge what actually people are thinking about in these kind of countries.
Now, when they talk about how there's censorship, like, of the web in Saudi Arabia or in Cuba or in China, how does it actually play out? Because you kind of, I'm trying to get my head around it, because, like, in Australia, you just kind of go, well, they can't really stop you looking at anything.
Well, that's true. I mean, here, I mean, there is, in Saudi Arabia, for example, there's a bit of censorship. Essentially, there's like a central space in Riyadh, and there are certain websites that are blocked, which are deemed to be inappropriate, pornographic, anti-Islam, et cetera, et cetera.
So is that like, if you're sitting there in Saudi Arabia, possibly you can't get onto the Amnesty International website? Cause
in
it's
a word,
blocked.
Yes. Basically, yes.
And are there pretty simple ways to weave around that?
There are. I mean, like in most places, including in China, which has got the most sophisticated web censorship in the world, there's always a way around it.
Because you can kind of test it yourself. Like, you go onto Google dot, you know, the China version of it, and you type
.cn.
You type in Tiananmen Square with a slightly different spelling, and then suddenly you can get onto those photos of people getting crushed by tanks.
That's true. I mean, I think what's also the sense is that most of the censorship is incredibly crass and pretty poorly done. So in Saudi Arabia, for example, there's actually not that much censorship. In Iran, for example, there is massive amounts of censorship where they have thousands and thousands of words and websites that are blocked. They never actually release what sites are blocked, and there's always ways around that. But I think one of the most disturbing examples is where you have, as I said before, an increasing example of Western companies that are assisting their regimes doing this kind of behaviour.
But their agenda is just making money, isn't it?
In a word, yeah, of course. But the difference, I suppose, is that it's not particularly transparent. So the average person in, say, Australia or the US uses Google every day to access whatever they access. But whereas in China, for example, the companies are actively colluding with the regime to make sure that certain words like democracy or human rights don't come up. And the worrying thing is that what they're learning in that kind of country, Google, etc., they may well then export back to the States or other Western countries, or for that matter, authoritarian regimes, which is starting to happen now. So
I was reading Google's founders defending themselves or trying to really sell the idea that they don't censor it, at least in the Western stuff. And then after reading a bit, I realised that their agenda, it wasn't like they wanted to be the cool guys who don't censor people. Their agenda was that they're this huge company trying to make heaps and heaps and heaps of money, and if you're perceived as
providing a service on the net that is censoring or not giving you the whole story, suddenly you're not going to get as many page views, and that's bad for business and makes you lose money. So at this point, it's like, at least in the West, these corporations just don't have an agenda to censor. They have got an agenda to do the opposite purely for business reasons.
I think that's very true. I guess the difference, though, with groups like Google, though, is that the image in the West, though, often is quite benevolent. I mean, I guess it depends who you speak to, but the worrying thing is that initially Google resisted going into China because they said they didn't want to censor their search engine. That, of course, changed soon enough. And I think, you know, because Google's motto is don't do evil, which are supposedly what...
Can you divide into at least two things? Like, for example, if one of these corporations like Yahoo or Google or Microsoft or whatever, if they start dobbing in people in Saudi Arabia or Iran to the government, mm-hmm. like that's one thing. But if they're just sort of providing a second-rate, slightly censored internet service to these companies, isn't that better than nothing? Because as you've said, there's ways to weave around the fact that, you know, you can't get Tiananmen Square pictures.
Well, I suppose one of the things about giving regimes information, that actually is what's happening in China. There's been numerous examples where Yahoo, for example, has given up information to the regime about users that allegedly were committing crimes in China. So there are people in jail now for years and years and years for that. Look, in terms of how does the average web user in China, for example, view the fact that Google, Yahoo or other search engines are blocked? I mean, interestingly enough, Yahoo and Google aren't particularly popular in China, and the Chinese actual search engines are more popular. Most people I spoke to in China, who I discuss in the book as well, weren't actually particularly upset with Google, and their argument often was, as you just said, well, yes, we'd rather they didn't censor, but at least they're here. Because what's happening increasingly in the West is there's moves to try and make these web companies more transparent, so some kind of code of ethics. So if Google or Yahoo wants to work in places like China or somewhere else, that actually they have to abide by certain international norms rather than just country norms. Now, that's how that's going to work in a practical sense. It's still being worked out. But I think it's a valid thing because, like with other industries as well, how Western multinationals operate, like in terms of, you know, I mean, Gap, you know, years ago was caught, I think, using child labour in India for some of its clothing, which is a problem. And to me, there's equivalence with the way in which web companies operate in repressive regimes too.
Now, it seems that one of the things you discovered in your journey where you got out from behind your keyboard and got on aeroplanes and actually met people was that the internet doesn't necessarily flush out that everyone's this great modern person and that communities in these repressive regimes that they want to become liberal Western-style democracies, that it kind of flushes out that there's a lot of what we'd perceive as, like, I guess, a-holes out there who just are pretty happy with, like, an autocratic, repressive religious regime.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I'm trying to say in the book very much so is that not every single person in, say, China or Iran is, you know, gagging for a capitalist utopia. Absolutely true. And there are lots of a-holes out there. And I think what's interesting also is in places like Iran, and one doesn't read about this much in the West, there's a very vibrant debate online there between sort of hardline Islamists and moderate Islamists. Now, how we view fundamentalists like Ahmadinejad is, you know, he's a very conservative guy who makes outrageous comments fairly regularly. But even the reformists in Iran, who are often hailed in the West as the great hope for the country, are also Islamists as well. So the actual debates that are going on about religion or dress code or sex or even other issues as well doesn't necessarily bring out, as you say, some kind of liberal ideal. And I think so much of the West very much is, well, if the web arrives in, say, Burma, or more so than it does, for example, you know, they're going to rise up and want to become like us, and that's just simply not true. Of course, there are people in China who want to have to model themselves to some extent on more of the freedoms we have here or in the US or Europe, but ultimately there's very much a sense that they want to believe in indigenous ideas rather than having ideas imported from places like here or the US.
Is there something irritating about, like, just say extremists in Iran who coattail onto this system that's the result of American capitalism and American culture and American legislation, and then just turning totally against that culture?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think most people, of course, don't see it that way over there. I think many people don't necessarily see it as a US invention or US technology or US idea. I mean, obviously, a lot of it was developed in the US. That's very true. I think it's just very much any technology is going to be appropriated for different people's use. And I guess if you raise that with Ahmadinejad, I mean, Ahmadinejad, for example, the president of Iran, has his own blog. He doesn't write very often, funnily enough. He's a busy man. But there is, I think, an idea, I think, that so much of how, you know, a lot of Iranians look at the US or the US political system and they sort of say, well, you know, their system is just as corrupt as ours. Whether that's, I guess that's a debatable point, but I think one thing that the web has done, particularly for women, is actually allows them to discuss issues about sort of either cultural relativism or gender issues or gender rights, which they couldn't do before. So, look, there's not so much this idea that there's going to be this overthrowing of every authoritarian regime in the world because, you know, they're blogging. Obviously not. But I guess what they are doing in some ways in some countries is really engaging with other people both within their countries and elsewhere they couldn't do before. Whether they feel like they're dealing with the great Satan, i.e. America, in the process, I think that would require you going to Tehran, John, and asking them directly. Have you thought about doing that?
Not even going to Iran, but even in Australia, on a practical level, it seems that the fact that the Americans run the internet kind of gets us out of spots of bother, like on all sorts of levels. Like we were just interviewing someone before about, you know, a Holocaust revisionist in Australia and about how the court is asking him to pull down his website. And then ultimately what's going to happen is it's going to be ineffective in practice because he'll be able to go up on an American website.
Yeah, yeah.
And I even remember when the internet started getting really big in the 90s and it was like, oh, I want to buy my name as a sort of, you know, as a so someone else can't get it. Mm. And you just couldn't. Like in Australia, like the way the system was with .com.au, it was like, oh, you had to process it as an official business name before you could take it on as blah. And, you know, and on a kind of practical level, the Australian government had figured out a way to make things quite difficult. And the way you got around it was, well, that's not what you do if you want to buy an American name. You just buy johnsafran.com. So it seems like that the fact that the Americans are in charge is making it a lot easier.
Well, there's certainly a lot of issues about the fact that America does have so much control of the web. I mean, that's probably the way it's going to be for a while. There was a UN conference, I think, last year or the year before where this was discussed, that many other countries were upset that America had so much influence and power over domain names and control of the internet. That I suspect.
But haven't they bought a lot of goodwill and a lot of brownie points? Like in that it's the other day I was looking at a website by a neo-Nazi, the head of the lead neo-Nazi movement in America, and he'd been kicked off, you know, something like Blogspot, and which meant he had to go on some other American server. And I just thought, well, if he's not getting censored, like who's getting censored?
Well, look, I guess it's also a question of how people actually view information on the web. Should anything be censored at all? I mean, I'm very much generally the belief that nothing should be. I mean,
seems on a practical level nothing is, except if, like, in the absolute most extreme cases of child pornography.
Child pornography, yeah, that's true. I mean, and obviously the Rudd government here is talking about possibly bringing in some kind of legislation that forced ISPs to block child pornography, and it's definitely a tough question to someone who, like myself, who's very much against censorship. I mean, child pornography is horrific, there's no doubt about that, but whether certain websites should be banned, because I guess the fear I often have is that I rarely trust governments to make these decisions for me. In other words, yes, child pornography sites not being available doesn't bother me personally. But then the question is, what else is going to be unavailable? Is there going to be then a move to ban sites allegedly block terrorism? And then how do we define what terrorism is? There's often a slippery slope. And there are discussions in America at the moment about these kind of things where issues about terrorism and websites that supposedly support terrorism should be or may be blocked. And I think, I guess, in the country...
But if it hasn't happened under 8 years of Bush in this very intense, over-emotional time, haven't the Americans bought a lot of brownie points?
Well, I guess yes and no. I mean, my book doesn't particularly... actually, it does criticise the US, but it criticises more the way in which the US government relates to many countries that I've visited, and often they deal with them in incredibly counterproductive ways. I mean, Egypt is a good example of that. Egypt receives the second highest amount of US foreign aid a year after Israel, and the way in which the Egyptian regime operates towards its own people and otherwise is horrendous. And yet, of course, true democracy in that part of the world, in the Middle East, would be a real danger to the US. So I guess my point is that has America earned brownie points? Yes, of course. I'm not saying that America doesn't do anything good. That's obviously not true. But in terms of how a lot of people in these countries view the US is generally speaking very negative. They may view popular culture from the US very positively, and often they do. But in terms of how the US government itself behaves, understandably, and I share this view and this cynicism, the results speak for themselves. They often support authoritarian regimes for their own ends, as does Israel for that matter. So therefore, that sort of thing I think should be condemned. And would you not agree?
Would I not agree?
Hmm.
Don't drag me in on this stuff.
He got it in at the end.
I agree with everything you say, Anthony Lowenstein.
And I agree about him dedicating the book to imprisoned journalists, including bloggers.
So what was that, Bob?
I'm saying Anthony's marvellous last paragraph of dedicating the book to countless imprisoned journalists, including bloggers.
Absolutely. It's the least I can do. It's the least I can do.
Thank you very much, Anthony Lowenstein. Sorry you couldn't get on the hack. Maybe next book. And also, can I just one final thing? The photo on the back of your book.
Oh yeah,
it's the same photo as last time. Are you honestly saying you haven't gained any weight or lost any hair since?
I actually haven't lost any hair.
Have you gained weight?
Since? No, I've actually slimmed. No, actually, there was no photograph on the back of my Israel question. This one, so we decided to really up the ante. You know, I mean, how do you think I look in that photo?
Right, you look like you're in.
Be careful there, John.
Backstreet Boys.
Jackass 3.
No, you look like you're in Backstreet Boys. Do you still have that earring?
I do have an earring, yes.
Oh, fair enough.
Mm. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Anthony. Mercy Arms with Half Right. John, Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
In gay Christian news... Dean Geoffrey John, who, if he becomes a bishop, he will become Britain's first openly gay bishop.
Yep.
And I think it's Anglican, and he's Welsh.
Hmm. I don't understand that. Welsh are not English, of course.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Oh,
British. That's all right.
Sorry, I apologise.
That's all right. Fiercely independent, Welsh.
I know it's a delicate thing.
Yeah, but in the meantime, your friend, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of course,
yes,
is saying, isn't he?
The most irritating man alive.
Well, let's have a bit each way, he's saying, isn't he?
No shit. He said, don't tell me. He waffled on for about 45 minutes, kind of like hedging his bets a million different ways. Yeah. Until you didn't actually know what the hell he was talking about.
That's the art. That's the craft. You see what I mean? And he saved the union, the communion, which I thought was excellent.
I really warn people off ever listening to the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's
Rowan. I like Rowan.
Do you think it's Rowan Waffle? It's a very annoying proposition. It's like listening to you, but without the jokes. A Glasgow...
My place.
...born computer expert accused of hacking into American military systems is distraught as he awaits extradition to the US.
Guantanamo Bay awaits him.
The parents and girlfriends of Gary McKinnon, 42, joined supporters in London for a demonstration outside the Home Office, calling on the government to prevent him from being handed over to American authorities. McKinnon, unemployed system analyst from North London, admits accessing 97 US military and Pentagon computers, but claimed he was looking for UFO files.
Ah! That's an obvious reason for so doing.
His girlfriend says he is a broken man, he is distraught.
I thought they were unhackable.
The what?
The US survey of military facilities.
Not for people who are looking for what they're hiding about UFOs. God, talk about geekdom gone wrong. There you are, just trying to find out about UFOs and you're going to be thrown in prison.
Yes. So he's going to be renditioned.
Yes. Poor guy. Did you hear about the Cuban punk who nearly... Cuba had ordered a jailed punk rocker, Gorky Aguli, an outspoken critic of Fidel Castro, to stand trial on Friday for social dangerousness, a charge that could carry up to 4 years prison.
What was he doing?
He was like a punk. You know how, like we can't...
Oh, but appearing on the street and frightening the natives.
Yeah, and, like, singing his punk songs.
Oh.
We're just so immersed in a culture of phoniness, of phony rebellion here in the West, that we can't even get our heads around this story. Like... Oh, someone who was dressed as a punk and was in a punk band actually upset the government enough to be arrested.
Mm.
And it's like, that's just strange, but that's what happens. But apparently he's off the hook now, as So
he said that he was only joking.
No, yeah, I think they've let him off. The anti-Scientologists are protesting outside the premiere of the new play by what's-her-face? Tom Cruise's girlfriend.
What's the new play?
Katie Holmes. She's in a play called Sons. And Anonymous, the anti-Scientology group, has announced they're going to stage a sidewalk protest timed to the opening night of the Broadway revival of All My Sons.
Fair enough.
It seems to be taking it a bit far. You know what I mean? Like what? Now you're protesting outside the girlfriend's play.
Yeah, it's a bit far. It's a bit far. Now, do you think Cyclone Gustav was sent by God?
Yes.
To stop the Republicans?
Yes.
I thought there'd be a simple answer to that. Thanks for that, John.
We'll talk more after this.
So haunted by cut copy, John. Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
This is from the Netherlands, I think. Almost 100 Goths joined the Black Parade and walked proudly through the city centre yesterday in a mass show of solidarity. Of, you know, hanging out together.
Yes.
The march was organised in memory of Sophie Lancaster, a young woman who was murdered simply for the way she looked. She was brutally attacked along with her boyfriend. Oh, sorry, it's from the UK, whilst walking through a park near Manchester.
A goth. Black fingernails and black eyes and that, isn't it?
Apparently. Sorry, can I flick through another
screen? What else have you got?
Sorry, I have to flick through.
No, it's
maybe
right.
You can tell us. Maybe
I'm not going to tell you about the gun in the boot of the car.
Tell us the story of the gun in the boot of the car.
No, well, look, it's too long ago and it's. I don't know whether it's...
Well, you don't know whether it's
when
what?
I was in the army as a uniformed person.
Yes.
All right? And I'm up at Wagga.
Yes.
Training, character training, soldiers on their way to Vietnam, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Kiddies won't know what Vietnam was, but they can Google it. So I take a few hours off. I drive into Albury. I go into the club. I play the pokies for 5 minutes. I come out of the club. I find a man siphoning petrol out of my car. Right?
Yeah.
I say to the man, "Hey!" See? Not prepared for this, and I don't recommend it to anybody.
Yes.
"Hey!" See? Now, he marches up the street to his utility, you know, and he puts the can of petrol in the boot. See? I take the keys out of his car and throw them up the street.
What? Hang on, I don't understand how
he's siphoning
happening.
The petrol out of my car.
But how did you get to his car?
I followed him.
Ah.
To see, because I said to myself...
How far behind him were you?
Not terribly far away. I'm walking into the darkness. Now, listen to this for absolute stupidity.
The darkness.
The darkness of Albury Streets.
Yes.
Right? Never. This is not to be copied.
Yes.
I think, you see, I must have seen Rambo or something. I grab the cars of his keys. And this is an unknown man, for God's sake. I throw him up the street.
Wow.
Say, "Don't mess with me. You've just siphoned my car. I can't do anything because I'm a stranger in a strange city. I don't know where the police are, blah, blah, blah." See? I say, "Well, come back here with me." I go back to my car because I know in the boot of the car, for God's sake, is a shotgun for shooting rabbits. In the old days.
Wow.
Now, look at this for absolute idiocy. I open the boot of the car, my car, for him to notice that there's a gun in the boot. And now, I mean, this is absolutely... I confess this on radio. You see? What am I trying to say here? I'm so offended by a man who's siphoned the petrol out of my car that I honestly think that we'll have a boy's what? "I'll show you mine if you show me yours." He's already shown me his because, in fact, he's taken me petrol. What do I think I'm doing here?
But you know, you've got the petrol back, was it just in a can?
Nah, it's gone.
What do you mean it's gone?
It's gone into his car.
Oh,
it's gone into his boot. He's got the jerry can in his boot. Look at what I provoked the man, for God's sake, for taking it. Why didn't I just walk or leave it alone?
And then what did he do
when
he saw
alone.
The car?
He said, come back to my car. Now, I said to myself then, thank God, this has gone too far, all right? He's shown you his and you've shown him yours. The next step, my son, I said, is going to be serious. not just a little standoff. So don't go into the darkness to that man's car. Right? You've done your little posturing. All right? Get in your car, my son, and drive back to the army camp and leave it well alone. Thank you.
Good lesson, Father Bob.
Is it true or false? Am I making it up? That is the question. So I'm leaving it wide open.
Kiddies, don't threaten people with guns.
Exactly these days. Don't threaten them with anything. Learn to talk your way out of things. And don't provoke somebody if they have taken your goods. For heaven's sake, just write it off.
We'll talk more after this. In fact, we'll have a Qawwali music. For
beautiful Qawwali music. Thank you.
In honour of Ramadan.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Devendra Banhart with Little Yellow Spider. God.
Religious Song of the Week.
This week, in honour of Ramadan, we will be playing a Qawwali song by a group called The Colour of Unity, and joining us on the phone to talk about Qawwali and the colour of unity, and maybe even Ramadan, we have Madkhil Sunny. How are you?
Good, thank you. Who's that?
Me, I'm John. I'm like the I'm the host of the show, along with Father Bob. Say something, Bob.
How are you?
Hello,
John,
hello, Madkhil.
Yes.
Now, happy Ramadan.
Happy Ramadan. Is that what you meant to say to a Muslim on Ramadan? Happy
yes,
Ramadan?
Yes, as long as you don't talk about food.
By the way, I'm not saying that my religion is... I'm Jewish. I'm not saying that my religion is sort of better than your religion, but when we have a fast, it's a proper fast. It's none of this eating after sunset routine. It's going through the whole thing.
But we survive because we fast for a whole month during... before sunrise and, before sunset. So that's a good 12 hours.
Now, we actually had a Qawwali group playing on this show a couple of weeks ago, but they were just a bunch of white non-Muslims who had nicked your music style, whilst you're a proper Muslim, an authentic Muslim. So maybe you can tell us how Qawwali relates to the Muslim beliefs.
Okay, probably I would say Qawwali started many centuries ago from Persia, and it spread into the continent of India and Pakistan. And it's most Qawwali is being sung in Urdu, and our group in Melbourne itself, Abdul Rashid, who played the harmonium and the key singer, and Robbie, who played the tabla, and I would say we are authentic, but the name Colour of Unity comes in because, like myself, I came from Singapore, and Mark and Aziz, who are true blue Aussie, and Sajid come from Malaysia. So that's where we Colour of Unity start in Melbourne, and where 12 months ago we performed at the 208 or 207 Muslim Music Festival, and we get asked to perform again this year.
Excellent. Now, the song we're going to be hearing is called Allahu. Can you please tell us about that song?
Yes. Allahu is Allah the greatest. So we keep saying, repeating Allahu, Allahu, and we make it into a nice music. We in this world where God is great, whether you are Jewish or whether you are Christian, both of us probably pray towards the same God, but we everything we do is... God is great, God is merciful. So in this song is God is great, Allahu.
Okay, actually, just before you go, I've got to ask you a question because I'm going to a Ramadan dinner next week. Pardon?
Ramadan iftar, the breaking of the fast.
Yes, and should I bring, are you meant to bring something if you're like an outside, are you meant to like, should I bring like halal cookies along or something?
Well, is it organized in the home time or is it in a company function?
No, I think it's at someone's house.
Okay. Usually like if you bring in dessert like sweet cakes because so you don't have to worry about halal food like you said, whereas I bought it in Brunswick, I bought it in Dandenong.
Ah, yeah, I see what you mean. So dessert or sweet cake. So if
I just
go up Sydney Road or something, I'll find that.
That's right.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining us, and
it's
thank you for your Ramadan advice. And
thank
now we're going to hear Allahu.
Thank you.
Malikul وحده لا إله إلا هو شمس تبریز گر خدا طلبی خوشبو لا اله الا هو تیرے ہی نام سے tere tere hi naam se har ibtida hai ہر انتہا ہے تیری حمد و ثنا الحمدللہ کہ تو میرے محمد کا خدا ہے
That's the, isn't it?
Quali.
Yes. The colour of unity.
Q-A-W-A-L-L-I. My whole life will come together if I get to lay down Quali in a Scrabble game. Because it's actually quite likely. It's not an unlikely mix of letters there.
There's lots of vowels.
Yeah, lots of vowels and, it could come up.
Now, they're on Monday night as part of the Melbourne Music Festival at Northcote Town Hall.
Thank you very much to Stephen Defoe, who's writing a comic book about the Knights Templar, and simultaneously was claiming there's nothing sus about Freemasons and Knights Templar. But, of course, when we frisked him, said, cough up what you do behind closed doors, suddenly he's not there.
Yeah, I got a bit coy.
And then giving
Deborah Lipstadt.
Yeah, he's like, that guy didn't understand, like, the medium of radio. It's like... And I was like, oh, so you're a Freemason. You've written books about Freemasons. So what's it like in a Freemason? Oh, people can just Google it. Like, how does he think that that makes interesting radio? Or that's why we wanted him on. We wanted someone to come on to not talk about their field of expertise.
And sing like a canary. That's what we wanted.
Thank you very much, Deborah Lipstadt, who told us all about Holocaust denial and censorship. Thank you very much. To Antti Lowenstein, who talked about blogging and censorship.
Mm.
And thank you, finally, to Makul Sunny.
Yep, and don't ring up about the gun in the boot, because it was long before guns were banned.
And now I have to... I only have 24 hours now, or less, to drive to Sydney Road to get some halal sweets.
Cookies or sweets. Yep.
Mm.
If you've got nothing else to do, they can always look up fatherbob.com.au.
Because I've told you, I've often at these... Because if you're invited to a religious thing, it's really dicey about what you bring because there's all these dietary kind of rules. Mm. Where, be they Jews, be they Muslims. Yes. You can't just...
No meat on Friday for Catholics.
Yes. Now we have to wrap up because we have to play a song.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners. Always go to triplej.net.au/Safran. Thank you, David MacDonald, producer. And, yeah.
It's goodbye from him and it's goodbye from me.
Triple J!